Okay, hey guys, and welcome to the Three Drinks In podcast, episode number 164. This is one of our Shaken Not Stirred episodes. We're talking about the movie The Spy Who Loved Me, one of the Roger Moore entries into the franchise. I am your host, Vince. Over there is your host, Phil.
Hey.
There's Phil. Before we get into everything, though, I want to remind you that we are available on all streaming services, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and iHeartRadio, as well as whatever one you've got right now. Make sure that you subscribe, tell your friends, and leave a review. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @ThreeDrinksInPod. You can like us on Facebook, and you can email us at ThreeDrinksInPodcast@gmail.com. All right. This is day 8 of the quarantine.
Is it 8?
So I've been home for 8 days. Actually, no, I've been home for longer than that, but I've been, like, kind of like sheltered in place for 8 days. I left the house today to go buy some more groceries, which is, you know, more terrifying than it ever used to be, considering the presence of, you know, gloves and masks on some of the customers.
So yeah,
yes, and the drinking has increased dramatically.
Well, that's encouraging.
Well, you know, well. So
for all our impressionable listeners, you know, don't drink too much.
No, just responsibly. They you know, made the call that they were locking down the whole state of New York today, and if you weren't an essential business like a food, like a grocery store or something like that, you had to close. I'm like, oh my God, that's the liquor stores, right? And then I forgot that I can drive to Connecticut.
That's good. I mean, yeah. I think the liquor stores are considered essential, quote, quote.
Are they really?
I think they are around here.
I find that very funny.
And if you can't, I mean, I've seen the liquor store delivery truck go by, I don't know how many times, like 100 at least. Like, I sit by my window and watch them drive by, you know, back and forth. So,
yeah.
You don't want to go in, they'll bring it to you, you know, wearing gloves and a mask. So.
Just leave it on the door and then run away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I am enjoying the Witcher meme that's going around. Apparently, there's a line from the Witcher TV show on Netflix where, like, the main guy walks into, like, a bar, and some guy goes, "Hey, it's you. I haven't seen you since the plague." And like, it's making the rounds. Like, it's going to be everybody this summer. Like, hey,
I haven't seen you since the plague. Oh boy. You know, sometimes the planets align in such a way that it's,
it's perfect.
It's just magical. It's just magical. So I have myself a nice Woodford Reserve bourbon.
Yeah. I got that for you, didn't I?
No, I drank that one. I bought another one just before this whole thing got down. I was like, you know what? I'm going to need backup.
And forget toilet paper. I need drugs and alcohol.
It was great. There was another good, it wasn't really a meme. It was just like a Twitter post. It was a picture of a beer case at a grocery store. And on one side you had Bud Light, and on this side you had Miller Light, and in the middle was a roll of like a package of toilet paper, and the caption was just, "I'm gonna laugh doing it. A decision was made." I thought that was great. Like, oh yeah, you know.
Truly, the memes are getting us all through this.
Well, yes, and this podcast, I assume.
I would hope.
We're doing our part.
That's why we do it. That's right.
Otherwise, why be here?
We're doing something, that's for sure.
Indeed. So what do you have over there to drink?
I am drinking a beer. I'm drinking, it's called the Power Tools. It's an Indian Pale Ale from Industrial Arts.
Oh, I love their beer.
I know, and they're doing free delivery in Rockland and Westchester counties if you want to order from them.
Oh, just over the border. God damn it.
Yeah. Ship it to our mother's house.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Yeah, their beer is good. It's expensive in cans, but the day they closed the schools, I went to the store and got some, and I was like, you know what? I might not be back for a while. So.
Yeah, no, it's it is expensive beer, but I have to say, of all the sort of local breweries, it's really worth it. It's quite excellent. Mm. So good for them.
Not getting paid to say that. So
no, that is not an ad. Not an ad. So, right. So, with all the time we have on our hands, at least I made a martini and I made three martinis and I watched, The Spy Who Loved Me, and you watched it today.
I did.
Yes. And we were kind of gearing up for this part of the sub-series and then like, oh, it's all the Roger Moore ones. Oh, it's all the Roger Moore ones. And like they're cute at first, but then you kind of get into the meat of it. And I mean, he made more Bond movies than anybody.
He did,
if I recall.
To the point where it was like embarrassing that he was getting that old.
Well, I didn't know this up until relatively recently. He was not only the oldest Bond to assume the role at 45, but he was the oldest to conclude his run at 58. 58. Oh, I'll say it again. Jesus Christmas. 58 is so many years. And like they're all giving Daniel Craig a hard time. And I'm like, I don't know. He's pretty young, but pretty old for this kind of a thing. But like, yeah, 58.
I think that's how you look. Because when he started, the first Roger Moore movie, he looked young. I would not have pegged him at 45.
Oh, well, no, but he was drinking the blood of virgins long before that.
Yeah, but I have seen bits of the one where his last film, and he definitely doesn't look 58. He looks older than that. Like, his face is all puffy, and he's got tons of skin cream on. You know, I'm not saying, like, that's a bad thing. But it's a bad thing if you're trying to be a mid-30s debonair super spy.
Yeah. No, I mean, and it's a way in which people back in the 70s could be photographed, number one, and the way that they, you know, could put themselves into certain kind of physical shape. I mean, like, Daniel Craig's, like, diet must be just sawdust and skinless chicken. That's all this guy can eat. And so the way in which they, you know, I don't think he's had surgery, but like, you know, they do a lot for this. You know, we know so much more about science than we used to. And so you could do so much to tell someone, okay, if you drink this green juice four times a day, your skin will peel back around your eyeballs and it'll make you look younger. Like, okay, great.
That's all?
Line it up, everybody.
Yeah. You know, I'll take two.
You know, that and, you know, weight training four times a week. So like, you know, we can make them look younger longer, which is good. But my wife even pointed out, because she watched this with me, just sort of how old he looked in this one. And, you know, his last one, you know, he's still, you know, 7 years away from his last movie. This was 1977. That was, you know, 85 was the last one that he made. So we have a while to go with this guy, and he was starting to show it here too.
Sure. But what did you think of the Spy Who Loved Me?
Well, I'm actually going to pass this over to you because, in keeping with the drinking theme, I got really drunk while watching this movie last night, and so. If you could just quick do us a recap, because I'm pretty sure I knew what was going on, because after a while it didn't seem like I needed to pay attention, and so I didn't.
All right.
I kept, you know, getting up to refresh my martini or get another plate of dinner, and I'm kind of going, and like we didn't actually finish it. I watched it the next day. Like I had like 20 minutes left. I went, oh, yeah. So it's kind of like the end of that movie. All right. So let's just, when we go through everything, just so I'm sure I didn't miss anything.
Okay. I always feel like there should be like a timer on these things. I've become like the recap guy. All right. So a British and a USSR submarine go missing, and they find out it's because somebody has figured out how to track the submarines while they're underwater. And they track it down, the machine, to Egypt. Somebody's trying to sell this technology, and the Russians and the British are trying to find the same thing. And they track that to an industrious billionaire who also has the technology. And the British and the USSR decide they need to work together to stop this person from exploiting it because it's part of their defense plans. And it turns out that the guy didn't want to sell it. What he wants to do is destroy both countries, cause them to create war with one another so he can start a new race under the sea, much like the Atlanteans in The Little Mermaid. And it's up to Bond and his other USSR counterpart to stop him. And there's a whole lot of shenanigans, and they do.
Okay, yeah, I didn't really miss anything.
Yeah, that's the basic plot. You know, it's not much more complicated than that.
No, it's really not.
Which is okay. Doesn't have to be.
No, it doesn't need to be more complicated than that.
It's about as wacky as the brainwashing supermodels to carry an infectious disease inside of them or something.
Yeah.
That one was still like, what is going on here?
I'm not even sure anymore. All right, so I didn't really miss anything. That's good news. This was fairly dull of a film, I thought. I kind of like recall so little of it. I'm trying to think, like, is that just because I wasn't paying attention, or because it wasn't worth, like, I didn't need to pay attention to it? So most of my notes I took in the first, like, I don't know, hour of the movie. And there's a couple at the end. I'm like, it just sort of randomly popped into my head, like, oh, this is interesting. But, you know, so things that stood out to me that were really good. I thought the stunts were pretty good. You know, they're pretty straightforward kind of explosion, and then guy jumps over this. The opening bit I thought was great. When the guy skis off the mountain.
Yeah, I thought that was a great scene. What an amazing stunt.
Yeah, so like we made fun of that for a while. We're like, oh no, it's the ski movie. We gotta get ready for that. And I guess I just forgot how incredible both that shot and that stunt were. And if for those of you who don't recall, Bond, in theory, really the stuntman.
Bond. giant air quotes.
He skis after eluding several Russian, very badly and obvious henchmen. He skis and shoots them and jumps over, and then he just sort of skis off a cliff in the Alps. And it looked like a single take of this guy, like, jumping off a cliff, losing both of his poles, taking the skis off of his boots, and then deploying a parachute. And this is one of those things where, like, they had a guy do that.
Not just any parachute, a Union Jack parachute.
Right, which is sort of the eye roll part of it.
You know, British audiences went wild when it happened.
And the thing about it that I kind of roll my eyes at is, like, just before that, like, he leaves to go do that, he's having sex with who turns out to be a Russian agent, but she's really some just hot blonde in a cabin in the middle of absolutely nowhere in the Swiss Alps. But, like, if you look at the set that they're standing on, it's like a high school, like, Abraham Lincoln play. It looks like a log cabin built by a couple of teenagers. It's just the It's the cheesiest set where it's clearly like there's just one side of that room. They didn't bother to build the whole room.
I love those sets because it's like, why would anybody put everything important on one side? Like the fireplace, the door, the sink, the bathroom, like everything is on one side.
It's like the play he goes to see in Godfather 2. Yeah. Everything's over there. There's the window, the door, the scenery, the whole thing.
Yeah, the mountains in the background. Like, you got to be really careful because if the camera goes too far, you'll see like where it ends.
Like a guy holding a donut, you know?
Like the boom mic operator.
So like that part is so cheesy, and then the next thing you know, it's this incredible stunt sequence where he's like skiing, and it's so the juxtaposition of the amazing stunt work as shot from afar and like the really terrible sets and blue screens, and like, you know, there's a guy going bananas down a mountain, and then they cut to like a close-up of Roger Moore in front of a blue screen, sweating while wearing a parka, like looking left and looking right and going, am I eluding them? You know, like trying to put a face on, like, this is, I'm skiing now, right? This is, you know, it's like watching a guy trying to pretend to play the piano.
Yeah.
It never looks right.
Yeah, it's pretty fake.
So, but the stunts, it was incredible. It really even nowadays, like, oh, yeah, it's, you know, because you know they weren't cheating it. Now they can cheat it all kinds of ways.
Yeah,
you know, they couldn't do that back then.
No, it was good. And like, I remember watching it maybe for the first 45 minutes to an hour being like, this is pretty good. Like, the stuff that's exciting is exciting, and they're not phoning anything in. There's not too much like wacky humor. There's a couple of quips, but that's expected.
Yeah,
there wasn't any like gags, you know.
No, it was a little, you know, verbal gags. I had a pun count going for a while. I was up to 5 really bad ones, but there were way more than that.
But he wasn't running across alligators, so.
Yeah, that's true. Which one was that one again?
That was the one he was the one down south.
Yeah,
right?
And like New Orleans and everything.
Yeah, with the drugs. Yeah, like, there wasn't anything like that. So
yeah, that was that Live and Let Die. Yeah, Live and Let Die.
You know, apparently there was like a return to, they called it a return to form when the film came out, and I could see it that way. He was violent. He was funny. He was quote sexy.
Yeah,
that's what you're looking for.
Yeah, it was sort of a more straightforward kind of a story at this point. So yeah, all in all, really can't complain about that kind of stuff. The main issue is that it's just not that great, and I think that's mostly because we're sort of jaded, and like this is the kind of movie that, you know, we it's hard to measure up to the kind of movies they make today. But that's, I think, the bulk of the problem. Like, it looks very inexpensive. Like, this, the way that they shoot certain scenes. Like, okay, so they're going to spend all that money to get that shot in the Alps. They're not going to fly Roger Moore out there, too, to do his scenes, you know. The whole scene in the, like, the Russian, I don't know, castle office thing that they were in. Like, just trying to give you the idea that like being in Russia is scary, so you're gonna be in like a castle. That was a painting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was obviously not quite, something was off about it.
Yeah. It had no depth to it. And my wife was like, "What is that? Like a giant matte painting?" I was like, "You know, I think you're right. I think it is." They were just in a small room where they just put this giant backdrop, and it's cheaper than painting or than building a whole room, apparently.
Yeah. So go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so like, you know, there were parts of it that were good, but there were parts of it that also just seemed sort of inexpensive in a way. I, you know, again, we didn't do any research for this. We didn't know what the hell their budget was or anything like that. But like, it just seemed like they spent money on, you know, big sets and a few other, you know, spectacular pieces. And so like small bits and that, you know, in 1977, we wouldn't care about that. You were more like, okay, yeah, this is exciting, this is fun, this is, you know. But now we scrutinize things much more closely, and so some of these, you know, obvious cheapskate type maneuvers sort of stand out in that way. So that makes sense.
Yeah, but it's not that the movie looks cheap, although it does. It's not that it's just cheap. There's always seems to be with these films, mostly the Roger Moore ones, this feeling of like cutting corners, you know? So first of all, they're all plotted terribly. The pacing is horrible in these films. Because I remember texting you like, I'm falling asleep in the middle of this film. The first 45 minutes were great.
Yeah.
And they stretch the plot out because they don't want to have all the action scenes in a row. So like the whole point where he goes to see the girl and then they go to see the villain. And he goes, well, when they get to shore, kill them. So they get to shore and there's like a whole car chase scene. And then after that, there are all these really boring scenes of them just hanging out and talking, because the scenes immediately following that is like the attack on the bad guy's stronghold. So like,
yeah, that's the chunk of the film that I have no memory of whatsoever.
Right, because you had too many martinis. That's a huge part of the movie. It's like half an hour. So like you have basically nothing in between a car chase scene and the end scene where they're shooting one another, but you have to fill the time somehow. So the plot just meanders for no reason. And I'm sitting here going, why are we on this American submarine? Like, what is going on here? And there's just lines that seem to be cut. It's like, well, nobody really cares. Just get to the next part and slow it down. Like dialogue is missing and exposition is missing. I don't know. And it happens throughout the whole movie where it's like, why are we doing this? I mean, at one point, they're in Bond's hotel room. She figures out he's the one that murdered her henchman boyfriend, which is hysterical.
He really was just a henchman. He was just like guy number four.
Yeah, you know? She was like in love with guy number four. And she goes, well, after this mission's over, I'm going to kill you. And he goes, okay. And the very next shot, they're dangling from a helicopter about to be launched into a submarine. And I'm like, what?
How like, did we get here?
How did we? Who is this person? Where did they get these flight suits that they're wearing? It was bizarre. You know? So, like, that cheapness extends to, well, we just have to get this done. And it's okay if we just cut corners that way. So the whole movie feels like that. You know, like the villain gets out his monologuing of what he's going to, his great evil plan. But it's pretty quick, pretty slapdash. You know, like, I don't even know what is his job? He owns a shipping port or something?
Yes.
It's just sort of taken for granted. It's like, all right.
Yeah, he's just, I mean, I think that was sort of the weakest part of the movie for me, was just how unbelievably, like, uninteresting the villain was. Like, they kind of give him a grandiose set to play in, but he just kind of sits there and, you know, plays at this big table and he kills that girl with the shark, and it's a shark. That's kind of cool. But you know, and I'm not saying that you need go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I do know that was supposed to be Blofeld and Spectre. And because of all the rights issues, they weren't allowed to use Blofeld. So as they kept changing the script, they kept changing like his name and where he's from, but like the basic, you know, megalomaniacal character stayed the same. That's why he's a little half baked.
All right. So the thing about these movies and their villains is that is the same thing you hear about every sequel and now every like season two of some spectacular Amazon show. Is that, and you can tell whenever an actor is like sent to a junket, or they film those like fake interviews. Have you seen these things?
Probably.
All right. So like a basic junket is like you go and you sit with the press, and like, you know, local Channel 6 News does a report on, you know, their features reporter will sit there with Daniel Craig or with, you know, whoever else, and like interview them about their latest blockbuster thing. And I began to notice it during Christmas time, but like the Hallmark Channel would do these fake interviews with the people in their cheap, shitty movies as if they were being interviewed by a press person at a junket, when nobody is interviewing, you know, this weirdo Canadian actor no one's ever heard of about like his role in, you know, Christmas at Marmaduke Park kind of a thing. Like, it doesn't really, you know. So whenever I see these things and they're like these sort of fake interview situations, and the character or the actor always says, well, this sequel or this season, you know, it's just bigger and better than the last. Like, and that's sort of how Bond works for a long time. You should take whatever it was and you just make it bigger and better and bigger and better and bigger and better. And I think the best Bond movies didn't do that. Like, Casino Royale, I have to think, we agree, is the best Bond movie, period. And that movie doesn't do a bigger and better. It just talks about, I mean, yeah, they you can maybe call it a cop-out because they went back and sort of retconned the character a bit. But he was just stopping a terrorist. But it was an interesting terrorist who had a problem, and he wasn't the main villain. He was actually sort of like a sub-villain of a bigger issue. And, like, you know, making things bigger and better doesn't make anything actually better. And this was a clear choice where they went, we're making it bigger and better for no reason whatsoever. Just because that's what the audience expects. And it's sort of a hollow, tinny, silly, you know, like, and after a while we just get really disparaging about this time period of film, because like the American audience wasn't that sophisticated, and you just put whatever you wanted in front of them and they would be fine with it. And that's sort of what they got. They, you know, they couldn't use the villain everyone knew, so they just invented a new guy who didn't really matter. He just was a bad person who wanted to do a terrible thing for a bizarre reason that nobody else would do.
Yeah, and yet he had hundreds of henchmen left over from the first draft. So,
oh my God, like dozens of them.
And the matching uniforms and everything.
So here's where I'm confused. This is just the only point, because, again, I was very drunk.
Apparently.
Yeah. Well, the martini is a very strong drink. The submarines at the end of the movie, that they blow each other up.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They were the bad guys' submarines?
They were the good guys' submarines being manned by bad guys.
Oh. Because he needed to get the nuclear bombs that were on them.
He had them switch targets to attack one another. So they caused nuclear explosions in the middle of the ocean, which is still a bad thing, just not in the middle of the countries.
It's actually where most of them happened, believe it or not. Like, you know, we've detonated over 100 of those things, but usually they're in the middle of freaking nowhere.
Right.
You know.
So they blow each other up instead of they were supposed to attack America and Russia.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I just didn't. That was the only thing I was sort of confused about. Like, where? So they took three submarines and they sent two back out there, and that's what it was?
Yeah, they took a third one.
Just to get them out of that boat at the end, right?
Yeah.
There was no reason to have that third submarine there at all.
No, not really. Because I was like, well, why are these Americans here? And, like, I wasn't exactly sure where we were. We can't just say the ocean. I mean, what country are we nearby? Where are we here?
32 Wathy Way, Sydney, Australia.
Yeah. Ocean Lane, ocean. So, like, they captured the American sub, I guess, just to have a spare? I don't know.
It was just so they could get like out.
I do like how, I guess, they were running out of money. And, the final showdown, he takes the jet ski to the guy's villainous lair.
Where did the jet ski come from? He just, like, pulled that out of his suitcase.
It came in parts from Q. Q mailed it to him.
Mailed it,
and it said,
to Dear James Bond at Submarine.
Right. It said like to Commander Bond on the side of it. I was like, oh, he literally mailed it to him. The stamp must be huge. And so he like zooms into the guy's lair, and then they talk a little and they shoot each other. And I was like, wow, that was refreshingly quick.
Yeah. That was the other thing I was going to say, too, is that, like, they built him up to be this big thing with this. The guy had a shark pool and everything. And he meets his end in the sort of the most basic way possible. And I,
yeah, it was like a Raiders of the Lost Ark thing. Like, he just shoots him, like, five times.
Yeah, but, like, I get, I think that refreshingly quick is a good way to look at it. Like, I was like, yeah, that was a little bit anticlimactic, but it didn't really need to be more than that, I guess.
It didn't need to be because his henchman was Superman. So that was kind of what you were looking forward to. Like, I mean, you know, the henchman, and this is Jaws, who's fairly next to Oddjob. He's probably the most famous henchman they've ever had.
I was going to say, he's probably bigger than Oddjob.
Literally. Yeah, you know, they're the ones everyone thinks of. Oh, the guy with the hat and the guy with the metal teeth. But the things he survives in this movie are literally ridiculous. He bites a shark in half.
I mean, we assume.
Survives a car wreck. I mean,
I couldn't quite tell how Jaws was killing people. He seemed to be sort of like making out with them slowly.
Yeah, it was like a bad prom date.
Yeah, and it was just so, they just died of awkwardness, I guess. Yeah.
No, raspberries? I don't know. Like, oh, no.
Give him a death hickey. Oh, no. It's terrible.
It just seems so inefficient. Like, he had a gun.
Why not?
And he was gigantic. Just punched the guy. At one point, he was ripping holes in a van.
Just wring his neck. Jesus Christ.
It's like a chicken. You just, you know, shake it a little bit. Yeah, it was a little ridiculous. So, like, you knew he was going to be have a fight with that guy. So,
yeah. So, like, and there was a huge chunk of time. I'm looking over my notes here, but, like, we didn't see the villain for like over an hour. We're kind of like, who was in charge of all this? What, like, why are we here? And that was not, you know, clear.
Well, it's him. So, he's in it with the shark, but then he goes away because his plan isn't to sell the thing that he created to help destroy the world, but like that woman who has no lines betrays him. And then once it's out, the people try to sell it and he's trying to cover that up.
Yeah.
And it just made the movie go on a lot longer because nowadays, I mean, we're a bit more sophisticated. Bond would do a little bit more in like investigating, like, where'd you get it from? Well, I got it from him. Well, where'd he get it from? Who made it for him? You know, and like he'd work his way up the chain. Whereas in this one, you know, he meets his buddy in the desert, full of his harem of women. He tells him where to go, and then the movie just sort of just falls into the villain. Like it's just like an accident.
Yeah, I forgot about that scene. So like, yeah, the movie just sort of. Things just show up and they move along and it's just, it's no thoughts put into it. It's always just like, you know, well, I know a guy who knows a guy and therefore we're going to find out what we need to know. And it just sort of ends at that point. Like, all right, like there's no thought put into it. Yet there's like some of the best Bond movies tend to be the ones where he's like, what the hell is going on? And he, like we become him where he's learning everything about the weirdo plot as it unfolds. And that's, those tend to be the better movies. You know, even Spectre, which I didn't think was a great Bond movie, like there was still a lot of, like all of it where he had no idea what the hell was going on. And you're looking at it through his eyes, like who are all these crazy people and, you know, why is that lady want to have sex with him right away? And like, oh, it's connected to this guy. And
well, even Goldfinger.
Yeah, I was going to say Goldfinger's a great example of that because they all assume it's like that was the great thing about Goldfinger was that like you're along the ride for the mystery of the movie and you know, you get there and you think, my God, he's going to try to steal all the gold out of Fort Knox. And then, you know, this delightful little twist where he's like, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do something you'd never would have thought of because it doesn't make any sense, even though like, oh, I guess. I mean, that movie kind of makes no sense. It's like, well, he, you know, blows up the gold in there and makes it, you know, radioactive. But, like, it was just sitting there. No one was really bothering with it. We just We just knew it was there.
Right. There's a misdirection and a reversal that you're not expecting.
And it's exciting and it's fun. This is very much like, this is what I want, and it's still what I want at the end of the movie, and I get killed for it, and that's that.
Right. Because what he wants is so ridiculous. Though I have to warn you, the next movie is not any better, so.
Yeah, I think we're in for a string of these.
Yeah. Well, it's basically the same plot, only in space.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, like, was there a discussion of how he was going to, like, repopulate civilization under the ocean? Was that discussed and I missed it?
No.
Oh, okay.
In fact, I didn't even know his thing was called Atlantis until someone mentioned it, like they already knew. I was like, oh, his obviously evil lair is called Atlantis?
Did we forget to bring this up earlier? It's called Atlantis.
Yeah, it was definitely like, oh, all right, we're doing this.
Yeah, like I always think of the Star Trek Deep Space Nine episode where they do the Bond spoof, which I love that episode because as goofy and silly as all the acting is, like, there's Garak along for the ride who's just like, this is not how this works. You know, you don't get a fast jet and a fancy car as a spy. You know, I ate bugs in the desert for 6 weeks. It's like, you know, like, it's a whole different perspective. But at the end of that little episode, the point there was he was going to, you know, blow up the planet and raise the sea level. So that's such that the only, like, place left above water was the top of Mount Everest.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, well, let's just assume everyone is acclimated to the high altitude. You've gotten rid of all the land.
What are you going to live on?
I don't think you've thought this through. So,
yeah, no, I don't think he knows where he's going.
So, like, I'm sitting there going, what, they're all going to live under the water? How? How are they going to do that?
I've seen that movie with Kevin Costner. It doesn't really work out very well.
No, everything ends very badly for everyone in that movie.
Yeah.
So,
let's see, what else do I have on my notes? Yeah, that's about it. All the big stuff. What'd you think of the theme song?
I liked it. It's certainly better than some of the previous ones. Carly Simon.
Carly Simon.
Yeah. I mean, after Skyfall, I think, you know, everyone kind of takes a back seat. Skyfall's my favorite one. And I like GoldenEye, too, but I have a special place in my heart for GoldenEye as a film.
Well, everybody has their one Bond film. So. Yeah.
But, yeah, it was a good theme. I didn't think much of the graphics for the titles. There's a great I can't think of the name of the YouTube channel right now, but there's a YouTube channel I know that there's a lot of different videos about movies and TV shows, and his was about title sequences and just, like, you know, how they convey information. And I don't remember if, like, the number one, it might have been, it's the one that, like, rates everything best, like 1 through 10. Can't think of them right now. But it was, you know, it wasn't the number one, because that guy, the guy that won number one, it was like his entire body of work. But the up there was like all these Bond opening credit sequences that used visuals in a way that was really unique for the time and both told a story and gave you an idea of what was going on, but, you know, drew you in by, you know, using silhouettes of girls and guns, and it kind of gave you a sense of the theme as well as the plot. And I always feel that they suffer the more photographs are used in them. Like the ones with Daniel Craig are pretty good, like the ones where they have his face in there. But here it looks kind of ham-fisted. They have, like, Roger Moore going, hi, and then it cuts to silhouette, and then he goes into something else.
Yeah, like, you can tell when they're, like, trying to imitate it.
Yeah, it looked more like a parody of itself, which is odd considering like they made these movies. This is what they did. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, I mean, it was just a sort of straightforward, you know, uninteresting, unspecific action movie that had really interesting locations and decent stunts.
Yeah, I felt that the locations were supposed to be exotic because it's the 70s and people aren't getting a lot of this stuff. There's no internet when you want to go see pictures of Egypt. So you go to the Bond film to see pictures of Egypt.
That's true.
There were also almost no fully clothed women.
No.
I don't know if you noticed that.
No,
it was like every scene was a girl in a bikini. I was like, wow, people were really hurting back then, I guess.
There was one, I took a picture of it, but there's that one scene where like the woman brings them into the room and she's like, oh, hello, you should come see this person. And like, she's got on the most ridiculous top in the world.
Yeah.
And the biggest boobs I've ever seen.
That could be any scene.
Yeah, no.
They were all like that.
It was pretty bad. Yeah, she brings in those two nerdy guys and she's just got this ridiculous like, you know, the top goes down to her navel, for crying out loud.
There was actual nudity in it. I mean, at one point she's showering and you can see her from the side.
Huh. I don't remember that at all.
Well, that's what three martinis will do to you.
On the train? This is
No, this is at the end when she's on that random American submarine.
Oh, yes, yes. I did recall that. Like, oh, look, a little bit of side boob and a little bit of nipple. Okay. Good for them. Yeah, there was another one where there was a little bit of that. I can't recall which one that was, but it was a little bit more nudity than we ever expected to see in one of these films. And it just kind of goes to show you how prudish we've become as a society that, like, you know, this is, you know, I always think of SNL as being the big barometer for what we'll tolerate as a culture. But, you know, you forget that some of these more mainstream pictures, which now are very, very clearly aiming for that PG-13 rating, because the R is a thing that, like, okay, like, you don't want that. It's going to turn away more audience than you want to, which is why some of the worst movies of the last 20 years have been like movies that were initially hard R's for their first installations, and then like subsequent versions of sequels are getting like a, you know, like a, I was thinking of the Die Hard franchise. So the first three hard R films, they were definitely adult action films. Like Live Free or Die Hard, whatever the fourth one was a PG-13 film. With Justin Long in it, for Christ's sakes. And those films, his catchphrase had to be edited because he couldn't say it in a PG-13 movie.
Yeah.
So, you know, whenever you kind of come across a movie that I guess is PG-13, this movie, but like, yeah, there's nudity in it. At the time, the rating it got, you know, it wasn't a hard R, so this is how they kind of retrofit it for now. Actually, gotta double check that just to see what it lists what the rating was, and it does not on the IMDb. But that whole process has taken sort of years to sort of figure out. And I remember, like, you know, it wasn't the first movie I thought it was, but like, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom was one of the first
definitely the 80s.
Yeah, like that's when they first came up with the PG-13 thing to say, like, we have to have something in between PG and R. It seems to be like there's a huge gap, and now they have very specific guidelines for it. But I don't think they retrograde these things, right?
No, I don't think so.
Like, once you get the rating, you know, in 1977 of, okay, you're PG, you know, which they, I guess they thought was pretty sufficient to say, you know, like, the parents have to make sure this is okay. Because R means restricted. We should keep that in mind. Like, you know, you used to be able to actually say kids, no, you can't come in here. Right. Now you can't do that. A kid buys a ticket online, walks up and goes, "Hey, I'm coming in. See Saw 12.
Nah, they're up to more than that, I think.
Good Lord. It's like a porn film franchise. He's relax. He's just my stepdad, 38.
Ew. So. All right. So, what did you think of Bond's counterpart?
Triple X?
Triple X. That's right. I forgot about that. And they never called her that. Didn't they? What did they call her?
She had a name. She had like agents, whatever your name
was. Was it Agent Triple X? I think it was.
No, you know, she had a name, but yeah. Like when she, like, that was one of the, like, one of the weird, like
Agent XXX, or, you know, I was like, oh God, Triple X.
No, she was Anastasia something or other. She just had like a regular name.
Yeah, no, I know. What was her code name? Was it Triple X?
It was just Triple X. That was it.
Oh, Jesus, that's awful.
And, you know, they did a clever thing in the beginning where they were like, you know, she's in bed with the guy, and he, and like, you know, she's like, "Don't leave, I don't want you to go." He's like, "Well, I have to go. I have to go do a thing.
I need to get a black cap for my mission." Yeah, because he's a henchman,
right?
But you don't know that.
No, you don't know that. And like, you know, the radio comes in and goes, "Agent Triple X, come in, Agent Triple X," and it's her, it's not him. You're like, "Ooh, that's a whole thing." And I thought she was exactly what she needed to be, which was just attractive.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's from Queens, by the way. I thought that was funny.
Ah.
She was American, which I got a kick out of that. Yeah, that was a terrible Russian accent and just, you know, staggeringly gorgeous lady, you know. But just like, yeah, she didn't have anything to do but be arm candy to this guy.
Yeah, me too. I thought it was terrible wasted opportunity.
Yeah,
because that reveal is great that it's not her, or you know, you think it's him, but it's her. So you're like, oh wow, it's the girl who's the secret agent, and she's the bad guy, and you know, we're looking at it from a different perspective for 1977.
And she knows things about him in that bar scene. It's like she mentions Tracy, the wife.
Right.
Yeah.
She mentions that he was married. He knows his wines. You know, he was in the Navy before he was drafted into the Secret Service. Wonderful. But she spends the entire film screwing up or going, "James, look out." and he does everything. So the whole time I was like, she might as well be anybody. It was very... not disappointing, but it was like, why did they bother? You know,
yeah,
they didn't follow through on anything.
Yeah, they just kind of set it up as just to say, like, listen, this is a, you know, they liked to play with this idea because it was just a very of the period thing with the Cold War. Like, oh look, there's Russians and Americans, and yes, they hate each other. And like their first couple of movies, or at least the second movie had a focus on the Russians, but they really wanted to really talk about the other super agencies. They never really wanted to get into the Americans and the Russians trying to kill each other. I don't know why.
Well, I guess there was some fear that, I mean, you wanted the movies to play overseas, but also like you didn't want to stoke fear too much because that was a. It was a legitimate concern back then that, you know, there would be nuclear war and the world would end.
Yeah, I mean they weren't playing in Russia. I mean they weren't, you know, screened there.
I really wouldn't do that with those pairs of scissors.
He says, scratching my back with a pair of scissors.
You know, there's got to be something else on your desk you can use to scratch your back except for giant blades.
I have a wine cork.
There you go.
Yeah, so like they always kind of had a friendly light thrown on the Russians in these cases, and that's fine, but you could make it more interesting. Like they kind of did that too in Tomorrow Never Dies, where it was the Chinese agent who was I can't think of the actress's name now, but you know, she was supposed to be as badass as Bond, but the Chinese lady version of that.
Well, at least they gave her a fight scene.
Yeah, she had some competence, but not. I mean, that they don't they. I don't think he, as a character, plays well as a partner. Like, one of the reasons I really enjoy the casting of Jeffrey Wright as Felix Leiter is that he's not meant to look a certain way. So, like, the Felix Leiter of the original movies is, like, the first movie, he's, like, very handsome and big sunglasses and, hi, I'm the American James Bond. And he doesn't do much in the film. And then later on, he becomes this goofy old man with like a fedora and a gray suit. He's just like a G-man. He's of nobody. He's of no importance whatsoever. And since then, like, every pair he's had, like, you know, there's been no sort of equal to Bond. And I'm not so sure that you can have one that works like that. That's why, like, Felix Leiter's character in Casino Royale is great because he's not needed to do much, but basically give Bond the money he needs to buy back into the game and win. And that's why his appearance in those movies is sort of great, because it's subtle and it's specific, and he's not trying to look like James Bond. He's just a guy that works for the CIA. And he's there in the thick of it, but his role is different. He's not trying to compete or even run alongside Bond. So when you have someone that's, you know, going to do that, you can't have Bond play second fiddle to anybody, even a lady, you know, even in these PC times where you want to make sure that we're not being too misogynistic about the whole thing. And here they didn't care about that at all. So it was just like, yo, it's another bit of arm candy that can yelp and scream and wait for him to do everything.
Yeah.
So...
yeah, I don't, you know, there's always the, and I always thought that, you know, like, you're right, when Bond is partnered and all of a sudden he can't do something that the other person can do, you're like, well, I thought Bond could do anything. But in this one, she can't do anything at all either.
Yeah.
And it's obvious it's because she's a woman, because he literally uses the power of his boner to get her to not murder him at the end. And I say that in the most affectionate way. He uses sex to stop her from murdering him. So, you know, like, at the end, she's like, I'm going to kill you. She has the gun in his face. And he just smiles at her until she gives in. And then they do it. I think, wow, that was easy.
I think the best example of a sort of partner character threading that needle of serving a role while also maintaining Bond's superiority is in GoldenEye. So he, you know, with the... There's the bad guy lady of Famke Janssen, who kills people with her thighs, which is hilarious. And then there's the Russian computer programmer that he picks up along the way in Moscow. And... you know, she basically is the damsel in distress, but she serves a very specific purpose, one that Bond can't fill, which is that she has computer technology skills that is going to enable him to complete his mission.
Right. They have to be specific to something, usually the plot, but they need to have at least, like, one skill he doesn't have. Like, I always think of in Tomorrow Never Dies when... he goes to, like, the Chinese safe house and they beat up a bunch of thugs. And he's like, we got to get a message and get our gear so we can take down the bad guy. And he goes to the computer and the computer is in Chinese characters instead of, you know, American or English characters on the keyboard. And he looks at it and he goes, I don't know how to do this. Mm-hmm. So she has to type the message. And I'm like, that's craziness. I know he knows how to speak Chinese and write in it because, you know, he's done it before. But, like, GoldenEye, she's using, like, super advanced technology with satellites. He doesn't know what that is, and nobody does. Yeah. And that's the whole point. It's plot related. Only she can do it.
Right.
So you're right. Like, that's different. In this film, they're both supposed to be super spies, except that she has boobs. So.
And no super spying ability whatsoever.
No, her super spy ability is to get captured.
A lot.
Which she does frequently. Yeah.
That happens all the time.
And gasping is her set. You know.
And then redressing, because she would maybe, yes. she'd get captured wearing one thing and then be tied up wearing a completely different outfit.
Yeah. Like, it's curious to me that only she has to take a shower and Bond doesn't.
I mean, he got just as sweaty as she did, if not more so.
Yeah, that's quite odd.
Yes. Oh, good times.
Yeah. All right. Anything else?
I think that's about everything.
I think it's one of the better outings. I don't think it's a great film, but you know, I was entertained for at least half of it.
Yeah, and I appreciated the absence of J.W. Pepper.
I felt it. I felt it deep down. It wasn't there.
His absence was noticeable. Which is as middle of the road thing as I could possibly say right now.
Yeah. Well, it was nice that they didn't have all that wackiness, you know.
Yeah, you know, the driving over a bridge and doing a corkscrew in midair, kind of, which they did. Like, that's the thing about some of these crazy, goofy ass stunts is that they actually shot them and they did it. Like, they had a guy in a drive a car which then twisted, you know, a complete turn and then landed on its freaking wheels.
Right.
It didn't make any damn sense, but it was fun to watch.
Yeah, and that's sort of what these are and what they're supposed to be and kind of what they've become. Like, the beginning ones weren't always fun to watch. They were interesting, though.
Yeah.
So, like, if you can find a nice balance of that, they'll be more fun, you know, more exciting to watch.
Yeah, and then that's... It seems to be the progression of these films, and they go through sort of like fits and starts. And I think Pierce Brosnan's run sort of encapsulates the entire idea. It begins very serious and sober, and then by the end, you've got a windsurfing guy being chased by a robot person with a laser in space.
Yeah.
And I literally didn't make any of that up to embellish. That's what happens in the movie.
He fights a man named Mr. Kill. So
and he drives an invisible car.
Yeah.
We could be here all day, everybody.
I know. You know.
We'll get there.
Five more years, we'll get to that one.
Yeah. All right. Well, if you have any thoughts that you want to share about The Spy Who Loved Me, you can tweet us and Instagram us at 3DrinksInPod. We are available on all streaming services, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. Make sure that you subscribe, tell your friends, leave reviews. You can find us on Facebook, and you can email us at 3drinksinpodcast@gmail.com. Okay.
Sounds good.
All right. Enjoy the rest of your quarantine, and please drink responsibly. We'll talk to you all next time.
Yep. Take care.
Bye, everybody.